Hello, this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is a French journalist, author, and political commentator. Her latest book, Notre Dame, The Soul of France, explores the magnificent history and uncertain future of one of the world's most iconic buildings, containing personal accounts of the fateful day that it went up in flames and the cultural war over its future. It explains why Notre Dame is so important to the nation and the world. And yes, we are sitting on the balcony of your studio, which is why people can hear perhaps some street noises in the background. And I wonder if you could just describe the view.
So we are on the fifth floor of a classic Haussmannian building. And we are on the Quai Montebello in Paris, which is facing the south flank of Notre Dame Cathedral. So from where we are, we have this quite amazing and massive view of the two towers. And also, although it's hidden behind scaffoldings, the well-known south rose window. And of course, we can see, instead of the roof that doesn't exist anymore and the spire, we can see all the sort of the exoskeleton, because we've got the seven flying buttresses. There are 14 in total, but we can see them, and they now rest on a wooden exoskeleton. I saw them being placed with a crane, and Philippe Villeneuve, the architect in chief in charge of restoring and reconstructing Notre Dame, told me he almost fainted each time because it's such a precise operation. And then, of course, the roof now is completely flat, and you've got this wooden platform and the white tent, if you'd like, protecting all the workers working on it. And underneath, you can see pictures and little films made by the workers themselves. You can see it online. And all the vaults also are resting on huge wooden skeletons, so that it's all secured now. It's officially, she's not going to collapse. But there was this fear for more than a year that she might collapse.
You were in this building the night she caught fire. Tell us about that.
Oh, well, I was actually on the first floor of the building where I used to live. I now have only a little office on the fifth floor. And, I remember that it was a beautiful day of April, the last, 2 days before that. Everything in Paris had been in blossom, all the cherry trees, and I remember going to the Tuileries Gardens the day before, and all the flowers were in full bloom, and the colours were incredible, and a lot of tourists. Of course, let us not forget that 20 million people visit Notre Dame every year. It's the most visited church in the world. And it was such a lovely time. It was ahead, just a few weeks ahead of the Cannes Film Festival. And just that spring fever, if you'd like. And when was it? About 7 p.m. at night, I was in the kitchen working on commenting on the President Macron's address. He was going to address the nation at 8 p.m. that night, following the unrest of the Yellow Vest movement. And then suddenly I just turned my head and I saw these massive clouds, and very strange looking clouds because they were yellow. And it was so massive, it could only come from something massive. And it could only be Notre Dame. So I just went to the front, my front room. I saw through the leaves of the trees, I saw some whirring flames. I saw fire. So I rushed on the quay. And then there was this eerie silence because everybody had stopped in their track. Everybody was looking at Notre Dame. Everybody was silent. And even the cars had stopped, and the motorcycles had stopped, the cyclists had stopped. Imagine, we were all frozen in time and space. And I saw that it was huge, and there weren't any firemen. because it had just been found out. Because as I say in, as I found out, as we all found out, and I describe in the book, the guard that was on duty was just new in the job, and nobody had told him the arcane and archaic system of the fire alarm, and he went to the wrong place of the cathedral when the fire alarm was triggered, and so it was triggered again 20 minutes later. But by the time he realized he had to go up the roof, when he opened the door to the roof, it was a real inferno, and it was too late. Even the firemen, I mean, I talked to the chief commander of the firemen, and they immediately thought, did we miss a call? It cannot be in that state. You know, is that our fault? You know, we shouldn't be arriving when it's almost too late. And it was clear. I mean, you don't need to know anything about fire to know at that moment at 7 p.m. that she's in the gravest danger.
You have written this wonderful book, Notre Dame, The Soul of France. And in the book, you go into why she is the soul of France and why she's important. Take us back to 1163.
Oh, well, I've got to answer first, you know, The Soul of France subtitle of the book, because what happened that night is that, you know, France is a fiercely secular country. And although, of course, France has used to be called the eldest daughter of the Catholic Church, and the history of France is extremely Catholic and rooted in Christianity. But, you know, in 2019, you look at a cathedral on fire at Notre Dame, and you know there's something far more important, that it's not just a church on fire. And we were just so upset. Every one of us. I saw some incredible scenes in the heart of Paris. People, you know, pronouncing silent prayers, and sometimes not silent. You could hear, you know, je vous salue Marie. So, you know, Paternoster, and also prayers to the Virgin Mary, and people on their knees. And it's a scene that you'd never see in secular France. I mean, outside of a church, certainly not on the left bank of Paris. And we were, and not only people just there watching, but throughout the world, I got messages from everywhere, from Japan, from Australia, from America, from everywhere in Europe. And also, because I had to comment for the images for foreign media, they were all asking me, we are terribly upset. Although we are not Parisian, we are not French, we might have, you know, seen Notre Dame only once in our lives, but we feel completely broken. What is it? What is it with Notre Dame that touches so deeply? And so that's the answer I wanted to answer for myself as well, not only for my British publisher, who called me a few days later saying, I mean, I was in tears that night. And yes, I want you to write a book to tell us why. So that's really a quest to understand. And also, you know, I went back in time, as you say, to 1163, the time of its construction. And I sort of identified 10 key dates in the history of Notre Dame that tells the history of France. Because basically, in a nutshell, Notre Dame is the place where the French have reconciled, have united in grief or in glory or in victory for 10 centuries. And so 1163, what's happening in Paris, in the Ile de la Cité, in the cradle of Paris? Well, Paris, strangely, is actually the most populous, the most inhabited city in the Western world, in the world at that time. And much more than London, which is a small village, or Milan, actually. Milan and Venice have both, I think, 200,000 inhabitants at the time in the 12th century, because they are powerful merchant cities. Of course, some cities in the Flanders, like Ghent, are also, because they are financial centres, are extremely populated. But Paris fulfills three functions, and that's the only city at the time. It is a university town because it's the beginning of university in the 12th century. It is a center of power and the administration and the monarchy, and also, of course, a merchant, an economic power. And the bishop, Maurice de Sully, the bishop of Paris, who is a farmer's son, is not a son of the aristocracy, has this vision. It is the beginning of Gothic art, and some much less populated cities in the northern of France have started building Gothic cathedral and says, well, I want my own Gothic cathedral. So it's a sort of stimulation between bishops, entrepreneur bishops, who just want to compete for the best and the most beautiful cathedral. And at exactly, you know, there's already a very old basilica, which has just been restored. But he says, okay, no, we're going to construct, as it were, a new one. And it takes, at first it's extremely quick, only 40 years to construct the what we see with the flying buttresses, that is to say, the eastern part of the cathedral. They will end with the two towers. And what is extraordinary is that period, the 12th century, is a time of continuous economic growth. We're talking about 150 years of economic boom. We've never known this since. And Maurice de Sully will put all his income, and at the time the Bishop of Paris has massive income, but it comes with his job, and he reinvests everything in the construction of the cathedral. And what is interesting, and that's why I found out just studying how it was financed, unlike other cathedral in France, it is really the palace of the people, because the people contributed to it, not only Maurice de Sully and not only the church, a bit the aristocracy actually paid into it, but the money came from the bourgeoisie, but also the prostitutes of Paris and the farmers and the peasants. And it's quite extraordinary to see that it belongs to every one of us because we paid into it.
And I think that goes back to what you were saying about the soul of France. It's odd, though, that it had so much reach beyond French borders, this huge tragedy.
Well, it's because when you go up, you know, we just talked about the 12th century, but, for instance, we could talk more recently about the French Revolution. It was a laboratory of ideas. This is where, I mean, we all remember the 14th of July, Bastille Day. But what did they do on the 15th of July? Well, they all flocked. They had just, you know, beheaded Swiss guards at the Bastille prison, and they all flocked to rejoice and to celebrate with the mass. That's quite strange when you've just been beheading people. But because in the... and they will do that again and again during the revolution, and that's the only church that will not close down, although at some point religion and Catholicism is forbidden, but not Notre Dame, which at some point is rebaptized the Temple of Reason, because it's the palace of the people. And also in their mind, in the mind of French revolutionaries, call it God or Providence, can only be on their side. Because, you know, after the night, the 4th of August 1789, when all privileges are banished, you know, after a night of elation at the National Assembly, when both the aristocracy and the bourgeoisie and the clergy decide to let go of all their privileges, they flock at dawn to Notre Dame, because there's nothing more, in a way, Christian than to let go of privileges. And so it's extraordinary. I mean, there are so many more anecdotes. At some point, it was also a warehouse, a wine warehouse, where all the wine confiscated from all the aristocrats were stored then. And of course, it's a fabulous wine cellar because it's not too humid and it's the perfect temperature. Many other things happened in the cathedral. But to answer your question about the popularity of and the fame abroad of Notre Dame, of course, you have to also go to the 19th century and Victor Hugo and Notre Dame de Paris, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, because with that novel, which he wrote in the 1830s, he saved Notre Dame because he started a whole campaign for its restoration and, in effect, for the restoration and conservation of France's national heritage, architectural heritage. There was no ministry, nothing, no public service dedicated to all buildings, to preserving all buildings. Mm. And it's thanks to Victor Hugo and a national campaign and, you know, all the characters in his novel that was a huge bestseller in France at the time and then abroad, that and the National Assembly not only decided on the creation of a ministry dedicated to culture and to national heritage, but also to dedicate hundreds of millions to its restoration, because it was about to collapse, basically, of neglect, 200 years of neglect.
Mm. Now, not only can we see Notre Dame from where we're sitting, but we can see a great deal of the city. And, of course, when you look at it, you cannot help but notice what Haussmann did. Tell us a little bit about Haussmann and his relationship with the cathedral.
Well, it's very strange, because if you're a Parisian, you both love and hate what Haussmann did to Paris. I so wish I could travel in time and see Paris with its medieval, because there's very few medieval remnants of Paris. But let us not forget, especially after COVID or, you know, at the end of COVID, that Paris was also so crowded. In 1832, there were a cholera outbreak that cost the lives of 20,000 Parisians. They just died in a matter of weeks because of cholera. And so Napoleon III, who was in power, who actually loved London much more than Paris, and I think that's the reason why he could be so radical. He had no limits, no restraints. He had been brought up in London in exile. And he asked Haussmann to, you know, let Paris breathe, basically, and to make it a healthier city. And the Ile de la Cité was really the place where Haussmann really acted more heavily, and perhaps slightly too heavily. Imagine 15,000 people lived on the Ile de la Cité at the time, and today, only 900. He just cleaned, if you like, or destroyed or demolished everything around the cathedral. And so in a way, today, I mean, the good thing is you see Notre Dame from so far away when you approach, you know, from the east, the south, the west. And so she stands, she now stands in majesty, but also a bit lonely on the Ile de la Cité. He also destroyed, you know, a lot of buildings. And now you've got the police prefecture just opposite, and you've got the Hôtel Dieu. But, you know, they are 19th century. They look a bit like military barracks. I don't think that was very fortunate. But we've got this huge square. I mean, he multiplied it by six, so it's huge, and it's going to be redesigned because the access of the cathedral is really has been a problem for decades because of, you know, 20 million people visiting Notre Dame, and I think they are going to use the car park underneath to make it, you know, again to ease the access, which I think will be wonderful.
I want to get on to the renovation in a moment. Just before we do, you must miss the bells.
Mm. I love the bells, actually. There's a whole chapter on the bells in my book. Because, yes, we all miss the bells. And, you know, there was a petition in 1802, just before Napoleon realized that he needed to bring back religion in France and needed to make peace with the Pope. There was a petition of all the people living on the Ile de la Cité, and I think almost every one of them signed that petition. All they wanted, they said, okay, religion is banned, fine, but we want the bells back because we miss them so much. And what happened is that for the 850th anniversary of Notre Dame in 2013, Notre Dame, and with a few private investors and American friends of Notre Dame, they commissioned 8 new bells, because I didn't know. A lot of people didn't know, except real musicians with a musical ear. But she was singing off key, and since 1769. And so I remember that moment when in 2013, all the left bank and the right bank and the bridges were crowded with people who came to listen for the first time to, you know, the bells chiming. What's the opposite of key? In key?
Yes, in key. Tune.
In tune. And it was wonderful. You can actually watch online. There are lovely films of that moment. But of course, they didn't move the bourdon, the big bourdon, that is to say, the biggest bell, which is, I think, 8 ton, or is it 12 tons? And the name is Emmanuel, and it's been there for more than 300 years. And it's only used once or twice a year for, you know, occasions like Christmas at midnight. Or it did chime, actually, for the Charlie Hebdo journalist and cartoonist. I was there on the 8th of January 2015. Notre Dame chimed for them. And it was very moving, especially, you know, the cartoonist being so anti-clerical, anti-Catholic, and yet, you know, she doesn't bear any a grudge. And this is what I was saying. She's the soul of France, because she belongs to everyone, to anti-clerical people, who fiercely anti-Catholic people.
She's being rebuilt now, as you said, and it is a chance, really, for the building to come into line with the modern world that we live in, but hopefully not too many changes.
Well, I don't know if you remember, just after the fire, there was this flourish of international and French designs. I remember some architectural agency in Sweden who said, well, we must have a forest there with endangered species, animals running wild. There was also titanium and spire, another one made of glass. There was this design and project of a swimming pool in the shape of a cross. And I think the way I see it is that we were so traumatized, we needed to, you know, to sort of get it off our chest and be completely mad and to think about, you know, and even myself for 20 seconds, I thought, oh yes, a contemporary gesture instead of the spires, you know, 21st century genius meeting 12th century genius, why not? But of course, after researching, after talking to art historians and people who actually know something about Gothic architecture, or Rem Koolhaas, that well-known Dutch architect, they all said, are you mad? Of course not. Because Viollet-le-Duc, the French architect who in the 1860s redesigned the spire and also restored the cathedral, did such a fantastic job and was such an erudite, because it wasn't kitsch at all. It was such a lover of medieval architecture and erudite as well, that you know, it should be rebuild the way it was. And that was decided by not only the French president, but the whole board made of art historians and the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, and Philippe Villeneuve, the architect in chief, who for 4 hours explained why it should be rebuilt identically. And that was the, I think, the wise decision. But it doesn't mean that, You know, for instance, the access to the cathedral, as we talked about before, shouldn't be redesigned because there's something we can improve the access for visitors.
Yeah. It's extraordinary sitting here looking at it, but also looking at how much work needs to be done. So when will this be completed?
Well, the good thing about rebuilding it the way it was, we have kept all the designs, all the drawings of Viollet-le-Duc. He was meticulous and so precise. I mean, the drawings are so beautiful. And Philippe Villeneuve told me, actually, it will go so quickly because it's so, fabulously done and every detail is there. And he tells us, he shows us the way. Also, it's going to be done with the same material. So in a way that makes it much easier and therefore quicker. Now, by 2040, what is sure is that it will be reopened to worship. Because, you know, that's a unique chance in a way. For 850 years, it was never closed. It was, you know, five services every day, plus 20 million people visiting. And so now they can do, you know, the job properly and restore also all the artifacts and the art, you know, inside the cathedral. I do hope they are going to get rid of the shops that blighted really the Gothic sublime architecture. I hope it's going to be emptier than it used to be and that we're going to find that Gothic space and they will put all the shops and the souvenir shops in the car park underneath. That's my hope. So a lot can be done and achieved by 2024, but probably not the spire. Part of the roof, probably. And, we'll see. But it will be a reopen. Yeah.
Well, what a fantastic companion book to come to Paris with, to sit here, to look at this amazing building. And to talk to somebody who loves her so. So Notre Dame, The Soul of France is written by Agnès Poirier. It's published by One World and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Christy Evans and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.